Hey, Hound Dogs, I'm David Hankins.
And I'm Paul Hankins.
And welcome to On the Air with Power Squared. This week we have a special guest, Gamal Hennessy, who is a writer, a lawyer, and the vice president at Global Comics. Right?
Yep, that is correct. I am the vice president of content at Global Comics.
And you're the author of this book, which you also have behind you. Here's somebody
mm-hmm.
in case you're watching.
The Business... Yeah, in the Business of Independent Comic Book Publishing, which was actually published last year and distributed through a Kickstarter in September.
And that's how we met you, was through through your Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
And we did an extra little tier so that you would actually give us some marketing advice for us.
Yes, we had one of the special tiers was if you got the book, you could also get a one-on-one personal consultation session. So we would actually look at the project that you're working on, because every comic book and graphic novel project is different, and then analyze what could actually be improved in your process, what parts were already working, and how you could move forward with and create a unique business model specific for your comic and what you plan on doing.
Well, we appreciate that. It also was your birthday on Monday.
Oh, look at that. It's fantastic. Although this seems a little bit, how do I say? I'm not going to get that cupcake.
But if you can blow it out from here, we'll give you a...
Yeah, I can't. I mean, I appreciate the gesture, but I just realized you got me a cupcake I can't eat. So
well, we're looking out for you, though. See,
I appreciate you. Okay. I do.
All right. So you're a graduate of the New York School of Law.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been amazed about people that go into law because there's so much they can do with it, a law degree. So what interested you in going into the law?
What interested me about going into the law was actually nothing. I did not want to go to law school. The origin story there is I was planning on joining the State Department. This was back in the late 80s, early 90s. But my mom, because moms all want their kids to be doctors, lawyers, or, you know, engineers or whatever,
right,
said, you should go to law school. And I fought her on it. And she said, okay, look, if you take this test to get into law school, which is the LSAT, and you get a bad grade, I'm not going to bother you about law school. If you get a good grade, then you'll go to law school. And I figured, I'll take that bet. And then I didn't take the prep course for the exam. I registered for the exam on the last possible day. I did everything in my power to not do well on that test. And then the test came back and New York Law School offered me a full scholarship.
Wow.
So my mom said, well, you lose the bet. And I said, well, clearly I lost the bet. I don't know what you saw that I didn't see. So that's how I got into law school.
I see.
By losing a bet.
Right. So did you want to go into entertainment law, or was this
my when I got to law school and I realized I had to figure out how to do something, I was going to go into communications law. That was the idea that I had. But because I wasn't really interested in law school in the first place, I was probably still reading like comics when I should have been reading things associated with communications law. But the way it worked out is I had a friend in law school who got an offer to be general counsel for a Japanese animation company. They did animation and they did manga. She didn't want that job because she already had a job. But she said, I know somebody who knows a lot about comics and is going to have a law degree soon. So she said, go to this place, talk to this person. He's going to give you a job. And I did. And that's how I got my first job working for Central Park Media as their general counsel. So we did a lot of licensing of Japanese anime and manga, licensed it in the United States, translated into English, and then released it there. So it's reading comics kind of got me my job, but not in like the good way. It was just, you know.
So that was if I understand your biography right, that was a startup company?
That company was actually about, it was technically a startup, but it was like 8 or 10 years old by the time I'd gotten to it. So it was a very mature startup.
Okay. So then you went from there to work at, so you went from there to work at Marvel.
Yeah, I was at Central Park Media for about 4 years until Marvel decided they wanted to get more penetration into the Japanese comic book market. They had an international program by and large, but it was very easy for them because of who they were and the characters they had to get into Europe or South America. They would really just call people on the phone and say, buy our comics. And people would go, yeah, we'll buy your comics because you're Marvel, especially when they started to get the momentum of the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies and Ben Affleck's Daredevil had been announced and things like that, and Hulk and Fantastic Four. But the Japanese market was unique in that there was so much saturation of domestic product in Japan. They didn't, they wouldn't even take Marvel's calls, much less buy Marvel's products. So they needed someone who understood how to negotiate with the Japanese market. Since I'd been doing it for 4 years, somebody called me up and said, go to this place, talk to this guy, he's going to give you a job. And I did. And I became the international publishing manager at Marvel, working on getting them into the Japanese market, but also negotiating a lot of their talent deals, working on some of their merchandise licenses. They had me doing a lot of different stuff because, you know, I was already sitting there.
Were you in Japan or?
I went to Japan once. I guess that was 2001. It was right around the time, 2001, 2002, not sure when, but it was in the fall, right around the time that Daredevil was going to be released internationally, the Ben Affleck version, not the Netflix version. And we were doing a lot of licenses around Fantastic Four and Ang Lee's Hulk. So that was when I was in Japan.
So how long were you at Marvel?
So there for about a year and a half, 2 years, because that's when, that about how long it took us to actually open up that market and get that product flowing into the, those, into that country.
So did you read a lot of comic books when you were a kid?
Oh yeah. It was probably, I think I probably started with like Neil Adams, Batman, because I distinctly remember being horrified of whatever Joker comic I was given, because it probably shouldn't have been given to someone of that age. But I was reading comics consistently then between the ages of, I want to say, 7 or 8 till about, I don't know, this afternoon, I was reading comics.
So you feel really comfortable in this field, I assume.
Yes, because I guess comfortable is maybe not the accurate word for it, because I've been in it so long, whether as a reader or as a fan or as working in various aspects of the industry. I don't know what it's like to not be in comics. So I suppose I'm comfortable, but I don't. This is just how life is. It's like a fish in water. They don't really know that much about water. They, you know, but that's where they are all the time.
So what did you do between there and starting Global Comics or being a part of that?
Well, when I was in Marvel, one of the things in negotiating deals with a lot of creative talent, you would hand them a contract and you would quickly realize that you'd say, okay, take this to your lawyer and let me know what they think. And you knew that the person sitting across the table from you didn't have a lawyer. And he knew he didn't have a lawyer. And he was going to sign whatever you gave him because he didn't understand what it said. Right. So when I left Marvel, one of the things that I did was I set up a company that was basically, the only point of it was to explain to writers and artists and other creative people, explain to them what they were signing. They may not have the leverage to like get anything changed because, you know, you're an artist and Marvel is Marvel or DC is DC, but at least understand what it is that you're signing. But as technology changed, and as the market changed and you had more independents come up, you had more self-publishing, the need for all of these creators and publishers to have legal agreements began to increase. So then my business began to increase to the point where I realized that they needed not just legal support, but they also needed support on the business end, whether it's talent management, product management, marketing, advertising, sales, convention management, all these other things. And that was the original idea for the book. I put that together over the course of about 3 years, 3.5 years. It was originally supposed to be a much bigger project because it was supposed to cover independent comic book publishing, freelance comic book publishing, creator-owned comic book publishing, comic book licensing, and comic book investing. But when I explained the ideas to some people that I knew in the industry, they said that book is too long because you're now talking about a 2,000-page book that no one will read because there's too much in it. He said, take the same idea of like a trade paperback and apply it to this project. Have the first issue be independent comic publishing, second issue be freelance down the line. And then when you have your 5-issue thing, then release it all as a package for anybody who desperately wants the entire industry explained to them. But most people are only going to, because they have one aspect that they're in, let them read that one piece. So it turned out to be a much better idea.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
So how did you get involved with Global Comics?
When I was doing presentations, as I was developing the material for the book, I did a presentation in New York, and the CEO of Global Comics attended that presentation. And we started talking about, initially it was just consulting concepts where I would help them kind of understand how the American market worked, because the people who develop Global Comics have a very deep tech background and they have a background in understanding comics in the European market. But because the domestic comic book market in America, such a strange beast, you kind of need someone to say, yes, this business concept may or may not make sense, but it's still what they do in comics. So you have to kind of wrap your head around that. And because Global Comics wanted to have a very strong educational component, teaching writers and publishers and artists how to actually release their comics in a way that makes it maximizes the success for them, as opposed to other digital platforms that just say, okay, put your comics on here, good luck, whether it sells or not. We try to take a lot of steps to teach people, well, okay, this is how marketing works. This is how financing comics works. This is how crowdfunding comics works. So we get, there's a lot of embedded support for the creative community in Global Comics, and a lot of that content and a lot of those webinars and things like that, that's what I focus on. I write all the blogs, I handle all of the Q&As and stuff, and I like host a lot of the webinars that we do. So that's my job. Because I can't code, so I have to make myself useful other ways.
Yes. So is it hard to get a footing in the digital distribution business?
It is difficult to, well, there's two pieces. One, gaining market share is challenging because there are established players in the market, both in the domestic side and the international side. But the bigger problem, at least with domestic comic book companies, is that they are very resistant to embracing digital overall as a concept, because in the same way record companies were very hesitant to move over to digital when they knew they had complete control with vinyl and CDs and cassettes, they knew they had little control in their mind when it came to moving to digital, especially since they had relationships with your record stores, your big box stores, all these other places. That's where the money came from. They were very hesitant to let go of that relationship. It was the same thing with your larger bookstore chains when Amazon came. Comics has not actually gone through that kind of disruption yet. Well, at least on the domestic side. If you're looking at manga or webtoons or tapas or any of those others internationally, there's a lot more people reading comics because they have, it's a lot easier for them to get the comics. What Global Comics is trying to do is actually create that disruption in the comic book market in a way that actually benefits everyone. Creators, the publishers, even the comic book shops and the readers can all benefit if we all kind of come to the table and embrace digital as a viable means of as a format.
So what does Global Comics do for a creator that, say, Comixology doesn't?
Well, the first thing is that there is a deep level of analytics that we can actually provide to every creator and every publisher so that you know exactly who is reading your book, where they're coming from in terms of your marketing, how much of your comic book they read, how long they spend looking at each individual panel, so that you have a very deep understanding of how your market engages with your work. And since we actually help you understand who your market is and how you can reach them, it is much easier for you to create a community around your comic that is going to be with you for the long haul. The second thing that we do that Comixology does not actually do is in terms of making the content shareable. Because if you, let's say you have a comic and you put it on Comixology, you want to share it on Facebook. What you have to do then is you have to post a link to Comixology. And a person who doesn't have a Comixology account has to go to Comixology. You have to set up an account. You have to put in their password. Then they have to go back and remember what comic it was that they actually wanted to read. And then they could start reading your comic. But by then, you've probably lost those people because they didn't want to jump through those hoops. With Global Comics, you could put a link in something like Facebook. Someone presses that link and they instantly start reading your comic because it's a web-based service. It is not an app-based service. So you could get a lot more traction with how you're, you know, doing your digital marketing, especially when certain you can make, and this is based on whoever actually uploads the comic, a certain portion of the comic book is free. So in the same way a trailer is used to set up interest and excitement in a particular movie, you could have, let's say you have a comic and after the fifth page, you have a cliffhanger. So people are naturally going to want to turn that page. Well, that's when you could actually, the comic could stop being free and then they have to pay for it. So you actually get them to start to pay when the story becomes the most interesting to them. And that's something that Comixology simply doesn't allow you to do. We also have ways to integrate whatever Kickstarter you might be doing with the comic on Global Comics. So you could use Global Comics to promote your Kickstarter and actually get more readers. You could use Global Comics as the digital fulfillment service. So you're not sharing PDFs that then can be pirated and shared somewhere else. We have a secure digital rights management technology. So you're giving your comic to your readers in ways that it's actually beneficial for them and to you.
How do creators get paid?
We have a subscription-based service, but the subscription-based service is not done the same way that Comixology or other services do subscription-based. The amount of money that is distributed is purely based on how many pages or how many issues that any reader might read of any particular comic. So let's say there are 1,000 comics in Global Comics, just to keep the numbers simple. And 100 people go into Global Comics with a subscription and they read, and like these 100 people, 50 of them read your comic. When the money gets divided, it's going to be not divided amongst the 1,000 other comics. If 50 people read your comic, you get your portion of that 50 comics. No one else who has comics on Global Comics would get that money. So it actually incentivizes you to drive more traffic to your book, because you know that money is not going to get distributed to for everybody. It's only going to be money. You bring the reader reads your book, you get paid that portion of the subscription.
We just put up over the weekend all 10 issues of Power Squared up on Global Comics. Mm-hmm. So we'll be, I guess, getting more involved in looking at all the things we can do there. We were just trying to get on there, you know.
Oh, if you, well, after this, just let me know. I can put you in touch with our business development manager. He can walk you through understanding how the analytics work, understanding how the tools work. So, and then we have an index of all the different information that we share on how to actually maximize Global Comics. Okay. So you let me know. I'll put you in touch with the right people. It'll be great.
Okay. I appreciate that. Because we're looking forward to, as we discussed in our little marketing a couple of weeks ago, we're just trying to open it up. We figure we have no place else to go but up as far as
exactly
readers.
Exactly.
Because One of the things I know you mentioned in your book is the ideal reader.
Yes.
And how to market to them. And we've talked to a lot of creators, independent creators. And I make a point, sort of a little market research on my own is, so who's your ideal reader and how do you reach them? And they're like, oh, I don't know. A lot of them have no idea who their ideal reader is, or it's me, or, you know. I assume that's fairly common with, because people.
I want to say if it's not 80-90% of people that are making comics, it's 95%. But that's primarily because comic book creators and writers are mostly, they're looking to actually express themselves through their art. They're not necessarily looking to do market research and market analysis, because if they wanted to do that, they may not be making comics. The problem is, if you cannot use the what we refer to as the field of dreams model. It is not a situation that if you write the book comic, people will come to read it. You have to, because there's so much content in so many different media that currently exist, if you don't find the right group of people to read the right comic, then you're running the risk of no one ever actually reading your comic. So
I think that's what we found.
What we try to do, but the converse of that is also true. There is a market for every single comic, no matter what type, no matter what style, no matter what length. The problem is, or the challenge is, finding that group of people and then building that relationship with them over time, so that when your book does come out, you're only talking to that very core audience. And that core audience is more than willing to pay a premium to get the content that they want, because individual people don't want just any story. They don't want just any comic. They want, everyone likes specific types of things. So if you give them what it is they want, they will be more than willing to pay you for it.
That's the goal. Because I know that a lot of people, they have the ideas, they have the idea like we did to do a comic book, and you don't think about hey, who's going to read it, but you just want to kind of want to pursue your creativeness without a lot, as you say, a lot of market research beforehand.
Exactly. But the way that we actually analyze it is that you don't have to change anything in your comic to do your marketing. All you have to do is take a very close look at who your comic's about, what kind of story you're telling, and then figure out, when you're talking about the ideal reader, who is that individual as a theoretical construct that would most like to read this story? And the good thing about releasing comics in the current market is that there are so many sub-communities that have already built themselves up. They already exist, whether it's on Facebook or Goodreads or Twitter or anywhere else. These people come together and congregate naturally. It doesn't matter what the subject is. It doesn't matter what the type of story is. They're out there. All you have to do is look for them, find them, and then build that relationship instead of trying to reach out to everyone or trying to reach out to your family and friends, which is almost always a mistake, because your family and friends are usually not the ideal reader for your comic. They like you. They do not like the story that you are telling in your comic. So you have a dissonance there that is only going to lead to frustration.
Can you have your comic book on too many platforms?
I do not believe you can have your comic on too many platforms if, and only if, you are actually guiding the right sub audience that you have to the right platform. So for example, let's say you have a comic and you know a certain portion of your readers like print, well, then it makes sense to actually have your comic available in print where you know that they are more likely to read it. So let's say if your target audience, made up of all your ideal readers, goes to libraries, then it makes sense to have the book printed and available in libraries. It also, if you know some of them also might do it digitally, then it makes sense to put it on Global Comics and on libraries. And as long as you're not putting it on platforms that are A, not generating any revenue for you, or B, is costing you too much to put it on that platform, one of the things, especially for emerging publishers and creators, is that there is a upfront cost to print and ship and store a comic. So if you don't necessarily have that revenue stream, it might make less sense to immediately rush to try to get into Diamond and get into comic book shops than it would be to build up a market digitally where the distribution costs are much lower. And then once you have that following, then switch to print. Or you can use the model of you release a lot of material digitally, then you build up a community, then you do something like a Kickstarter or crowdfunding, where the Kickstarter community that you built up, they actually cover the cost of the printing. So it's not a situation where you are in the hole because you're trying to like spread out the message. What I think a lot of people run into is the issue of, well, I don't know who's going to buy my comic and I don't know where they are. So I'm going to put it in as many places as possible and hope that I get lucky. Just basically spreading out the bet. Mm-hmm. You would have more success, I believe, figuring out exactly who's going to read it, figuring out where those people buy comics or where those people consume stories, and then just go there and not worry about other places because other places are not going to help you anyway.
We watched your, you were on a Zoom call about Kickstarters. We spent a lot of time with you in the last few weeks.
Well, then you must get sick of looking at this wall. I'm sorry about that.
Well, it's okay. We'll forget it this time. But during that Kickstarter, you mentioned if you want to have crowdfunding, you have to have a crowd, which I think was very kind of, it's sort of simple, but it's very useful information. You know, they're not going to find you at Kickstarter, but you're going to bring people to it. Right.
Exactly. It's the kind of thing. And this is that it's not an original idea because I got that phrase from a book called CrowdStart, which I believe Ariel Hyatt wrote. But her fundamental concept was without a crowd, there is no funding. So the idea that people will just be wandering through Kickstarter with money in their pocket that's burning a hole in there that they need to spend is not an accurate representation of how Kickstarter works. If you build up a community, if you have people that are interested in what it is that you are doing, then you launch a Kickstarter. It's much easier to get those people to donate money to what it is that they already like. It is also easier for those people, and they may be a small group of people, to then reach out to people that they know because the networks will expand. They know more people than you know. So if you have like 100 people that are really into what you're doing and they reach out, each one of them reaches out to one person, you've doubled your size without doing anything other than giving them what it is that they're looking for. That's how you build up a crowd or a market for crowdfunding. And it's not this kind of, because there was a lot of controversy over the past 6-7 months with a lot of celebrities and established publishers starting Kickstarters. And the argument against that was, well, they're taking money or they're taking people away from established projects. And I don't believe that's how crowdfunding and Kickstarter works. If you had a crowd, if your comic book was about, was a historical romantic comedy, then the fact that Keanu Reeves had a dystopian, like mercenary, like revenge tale has nothing to do with your comic or your crowd. Those people wouldn't care about that comic anyway. Right. So why would that be a problem? And if you look at it from the opposite angle, if we're saying you need a crowd to get funding and you have to build your crowd over time, well, if someone like Keanu Reeves has spent the past 25 years building up his crowd through the things that he's doing, and then he decides, well, I'm going to make a comic. Well, yeah, if you had a crowd of 8 million people, you might use that crowd too. So why is it a problem if someone else is doing it? So that's my position. That is not the official Global Comics position, I don't think. That's my position.
So is that, do you think, the biggest mistake that Kickstarter people make is they don't have a crowd going in?
I think the biggest mistake that all comic book creators and publishers, and this is not necessarily limited to independents, is that they do not have a viable business model set up before they start making their comic. The reason I structured the book the way that I did is that there are significant steps and significant decisions that have to be made in making a comic between the point where you get the inspiration to make a comic and the time that you actually start producing the comic. Like, why are you making this comic? What are you trying to achieve? How are you going to pay for it? Who's going to make it? Who's going to read it? How are you going to get the book to the people who want to read it? Once you know all of those things, there are a lot of decisions that need to be made in that process. Then when it comes time to make the comic, you're in a much better space because it's not guessing. You're not trying to make things just based on a whim, a guess, or you're not stumbling in the dark. So then when it comes time to make the book, you know exactly what book to make, when to make it, how it's going to be made. And then when it's time to release it, you know how much you need to sell to make it profitable or even break even. You know where it needs to go. You know where the money is going to come from to actually cover the cost. And you can actually repeat that cycle because you didn't throw a lot of time, money, energy, and stress into this first book because you kind of just went from, I want to make a comic, and you started drawing, and now you didn't know what to do next.
One of the things you talk about in your book is LLCs.
Mm-hmm.
Should all creators have an LLC, or what would be the situation?
It depends a lot on what it is that you're trying to achieve and how long you plan to be in the comic book business and what business you actually plan to be in. I put in the idea that you should consider creating some corporate form, because corporations, whether it's an LLC or a C Corp or a partnership or whatever, will actually help you protect your assets, which is the idea for the comic and the money that you put into the comic. And it will also protect you from a certain level of liability if there's some kind of legal or business issue with the comic later on. And there are certain tax incentives that you can, because you create a viable business, you create viable business expenses. So all the things that you spend money on to get this comic book out the door is something that you could actually use to your benefit in working with your accountant to actually put yourself in a better financial position after the comic book comes out. LLCs is one option, and it is usually the more flexible option depending on what state that you're living in. But you could also create a C Corp. You could create a partnership. You could do a sole proprietorship. In the book, I list out the pros and cons of each form so that you could actually understand, well, okay, I ultimately want to have an IPO because I ultimately want to get bought out by, I don't know, Disney or something. Well, then you are more likely to want to have a C Corp than an LLC. If you're going to be publishing the books on your own, and you're not really going to be giving ownership of the property to anyone else, then a single member LLC makes more sense. But there are a lot of different moving parts in that decision that you should take into account together with your accountant and your legal advisor to figure out which way to go.
One of them is the expense of setting up an LLC is also, they're not cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are work for hire agreements enough to cover, let's say, you know, we're writers and we've hired people to actually draw and color and, I guess, letter the comic book. Is that enough to cover us as far as?
It as long as the work for hire agreement was drafted in the right way and you actually secure all the legal rights to the intellectual property that you have someone create for you, mm-hmm. then you should be fine with a work for hire agreement so long as everyone who's involved in the comic signs that work for hire agreement and they actually adhere to the terms of that agreement. It should be fine.
Okay. I'm asking in general for anybody that might be watching. So you have any questions you want to ask?
See, I guess I'll ask, what was the convention scene like for you before COVID?
Before COVID, it was the situation, because of the nature of the services that I provide, there was no reason for me to ever get a table, because I have to be kind of a moving target.
Right.
You have to be on panels, you have to attend panels, you have to walk around Artist Alley to meet your clients, meet potential new clients. You have to be available for BarCon afterwards to because that's where the real magic happens. And being a comic book fan, you want to be able to walk the show floor and see all the cool stuff, right? So what I usually did was I always hit New York Comic Con, because that's the easiest thing to do. It's just a train ride. But then sometimes I would go to the cons in Austin and Charlotte and Orlando and things like that. It was usually a place where you get to see a lot of the people that you've worked with over the years, because comic books is such a geographically dispersed production cycle. People who are making comics together often are not living in the same city or even in the same country, depending on how it's structured. But the one place you can get together is Comic-Con. So that was always something that you look forward to, something that we lost in 2020 because we replaced everything with Zoom calls.
Yeah, I mean, maybe losing it in 2021. Have you been to San Diego Comic-Con?
I was only in San Diego Comic-Con once, and that was back when I was with Marvel. And because it's much easier to get into San Diego Comic-Con when you're with one of the larger comic book publishers, as to just slightly get on your own. And B, I felt like even when I was with Marvel, it was a kind of thing, and this was back in 2002, San Diego Comic-Con was too much. There's too much people, there was too much stuff happening, there was too much. And I spent most of that con behind in the Marvel booth. I didn't really go anywhere except to do meetings. And I never left the convention center, so I never actually saw San Diego. I was just stuck in that little fishbowl for 4 days. So since then, I said, if someone is going to invite me to San Diego, sure, I'll go. But I'm not fighting to get a hotel room and a flight. And no, it's easier to just go to New York Comic Con or Heroes Con or C2E2 or,
Okay. We've done Comic Con a lot, mostly as regular
attendees.
Yeah. And it was always exhausting no matter what we did.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, keep in mind, there's some people whose their entire distribution system is based on cons. And because in normal years, there was literally at least one con every weekend in some part of the country, big or small. If you were tired after one con over one weekend, imagine doing 20 or 30 of those, over the course of a year.
Yeah.
And dragging around, all the stuff for your booth and dragging around your material to sell and having to meet with people and do other things. It's a job. I mean, all of us and a lot of people that I've talked to over the past 4 months are anxious to get back to conventions, but conventions, and we've probably forgotten this because we haven't been able to go for a year. Conventions are a job, and you gotta pace yourself. You gotta have a lot of water. Your phone's got to get charged somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we're missing going, actually.
Yes.
It's one of those things once the whole thought of going is it's going to be this thing you have to go through. But after I go to those, it's hard to go back to work, my regular job. Uh-huh. I want to live in that world, not in the world I'm living.
Exactly. Exactly. And the sooner, the more comic book creators can actually develop viable business models where their comics are actually making them enough money, where they don't actually, that is their life, that is their job. So you just, you make comics, you go to conventions, you eat. That's all you really have to do. There is no more regular job. Regular jobs go out the window.
Well, okay. So far, that's not the case for me. Is there something we covered that you would like to talk about?
I think one of the things that we should cover that we didn't actually cover is the way you actually set up how this book, whatever book you're going to make, whatever project you're going to do, how are you actually going to, A, get it off the ground financially before it's released? Because depending on how you're going to make your comic, there's some form of finances that have to go into it. Whether you're paying, like you said, you're paying artists and letterers and flatters and colorists, whether you're paying for printing, whether you're paying, you know, legal fees, accounting fees. You have to kind of sit back and go, okay, where's that money going to come from? And how am I going to make sure that I'm not, you know, spending my rent or my kids' college fund and I'm still eating? How do you actually do that? And then once the book comes out and once you actually have that completed thing, what is it that you do next? Because in the same way a musician can't get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame most of the time if they have one song. And, you know, a successful athlete can't get into the Hall of Fame of any sport if you have one good game. You've got to build that over time. So are you going to keep making the comic in the same series that you did? Are you going to continue to be independent? Are you going to try to be a freelance publisher? Are you going to try to get a creator-owned deal? There are a lot of different avenues that you could pursue in having a career in comics. A career in comics, there's a lot of, it's a broad umbrella. And you could be in several different aspects of that industry. You just have to decide which ones you want to be in. And that will actually guide a lot of your decisions and how you actually make your books, what projects you take on, what do you do and don't do. So you actually get to where you want to be ultimately in your comic book career. Because ultimately, I think it should be a career and not just something that you put a lot of like time and energy into and then just put on the shelf.
Right.
I agree with that. One more thing is you're working on a new book.
Yes. Yes. It's the follow-up book to the business of independent comic publishing. And this book will focus specifically on freelance comic book publishing because there's most of the people working in comics are freelance. They don't own the intellectual property that they're working on. They don't make more money if the book does well. They don't necessarily make less money if the book doesn't sell at all. But they're basically just, it is the gig economy at its most pure, and it's the gig economy before there was a gig economy. Mm-hmm. Freelance writers, freelance artists, letterers, colorists, flatters, designers, marketers, publicists, print managers. So this book is actually focusing on how they can develop their business so it makes it profitable for them and they can protect themselves from a business and legal standpoint. A lot of the concepts from the independent book will be in there from a different perspective, but there'll also be elements that are specific to running a freelance business that I'm focusing on now. So we're doing the research for the book now. The writing will probably start in September. And depending on how things go with my agent and stuff, hopefully the book will be ready for New York Comic Con 2022.
Wow. Have you ever tried to create a comic book yourself?
Well, the story is I still have, an idea for a comic, and I sat down with a artist who was a friend of mine from my days back at Marvel, and we were going to create this book. Well, it was supposed to be a graphic novel. We were going to start with our first 22 pages. And he said, after we signed the deal and we squared away the intellectual property rights, because I'm a lawyer, we said, okay, he had a Kickstarter project that he needed to wrap up. But as soon as that Kickstarter project was wrapped up, we're going to dig into making this book. That Kickstarter, they were looking to get like $10,000, I think. I think they made like $140,000. They got a film agent. The option for the comic got picked up by a Hollywood studio. They had to make like four other graphic novels in this series. So he like sent me an email and said, you know that project that you and I were going to work on? It's never going to happen. So, and then I started writing this book. So, and now there's other books in the series. So that comic may never happen, but I still got the script. So, you know, maybe a side project is I'll just hire a team of people to do it, and then I'll just let them do it. And then I'll just, you know, that may be how it happens, but yeah.
I'm just curious, since you're so involved in the marketing and all that.
It is almost, I believe it's almost impossible for anyone involved in the business of comics to not decide, or at least think of at some point, I can make a comic, I could do this. Whether they do it or not is a different story. But I believe that thought passes through the head of everyone in comics.
All right. So if people wanted to follow you or get in touch with you, what would be the best way for them to do that?
They can find me on Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn through just my name, GamalHennessy. If they wanted to visit my website, it is creativecontractconsulting.com. That's all one word, all lowercase. And those would be the two best ways to find me. If they wanted to get a free legal consultation on a comic book project that they are working on, they can just go to my website. There's a contact page. You send me an email and we set up the free consultation. No worries.
All right. Well, we'll be actually seeing you on Monday to have that free
legal consultation. Because you set up a slot on Monday.
Right. All right. So we want to thank you for being on the show. Let you know you can go have your dinner and drinks or whatever you're going to do.
It's fantastic.
And celebrate the weekend. And we'll see you on Monday.
Exactly.
All right.
Stay safe till then.
All right. So until next time, I'm David Hankins.
And I'm Paul Hankins.
And you've been on the air with Power Squared.